This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October the 27th, 2021. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown, coming to you on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. Let's hit the horns and go. Coming up on the show today, veteran political correspondent Craig Oliver will give his perspective on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's new cabinet. Rachel Sampson shares findings from a sink or swim report, a new climate change report by the Canadian Institute for Climate Choices. Mike Agarbo of The App Show will tell you about the newest edition of the Apple AirPods. A little headphone talk with Mike Agarbo. Thought about that. But you know what? I'll keep the thought for a little bit later. Community artist Clover Thursday introduces her brand new segment on arts and culture. And community reporter Amy Amanti describes Vocalize's new virtual production, Done-Undone. Looking forward to catching up with all those folks over the course of the next couple of hours here on the show. Happy to catch up with you as well. Thank you for making time to be with us today. Let's begin the show with our top story of the day, and that's taking a look at the new cabinet, the new federal cabinet. And we'll do some analysis with Craig later, but I want to introduce you to a couple new faces and share some sound. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says Canadians are expecting big things from this parliament and his government. He says they expect Canada to step up its efforts on fighting climate change, work harder on reconciliation, and build back better to include everyone.
These are no small tasks. These are the things that Canadians expect us to do. And with a refreshed and reinvigorated team around me, I'm really excited about what we're going to be able to accomplish for Canadians. And I know that this team is raring to go.
Trudeau had a one-word answer when reporters asked if he would run in the next election, an emphatic yes. Canada's new environment minister is Stephen Guibeau. Stephen Guibeau says the plan is to continue and accelerate the fight against climate change. He points out the Trudeau government has made some ambitious commitments.
Namely, to cap emissions from oil and gas sector at current level and then diminishing over time so that we reach net zero by 2050. And also to phase out 2 years before our G20 country partners fossil fuel subsidies. So the G20 commitment is to phase them out by 2025. We've committed to do that by 2023.
Guibeau has previously opposed pipelines and expansion of the oil industry. Trudeau was asked whether Guibeau's advocacy background sends a signal to the oil and gas sector.
For most Canadians, and indeed most Albertans, we know that we need to look towards the future. We need to bring people along, support them in the jobs they need to have, but also lower our emissions so we get to net zero. Indeed, the largest energy companies in this country are committed to net zero by 2050.
Former Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller is taking on a more diplomatic role as the Minister of Crown Indigenous Affairs. He says his focus during the pandemic was to keep people alive, and the greatest impediment was not a lack of resources, it was a lack of trust. He hopes he's now built up a degree of trust with First Nations that he can bring to the new role.
This relationship started with land. The relationship has been broken because of land theft. And it's time to give land back. And that's just the reality of it. It's easily said, it's more difficultly done.
Miller replaces Minister Carolyn Bennett, who faces criticism for withholding documents related to abuses at the St. Anne's Residential School. Bennett was shuffled to a new role as Minister of Mental Health and Addictions. The fight against sexual misconduct in the military, the Canadian Armed Forces, will be front and center for new Minister of Defense Anita Anand. Anand says she has a game plan and it already starts with a full review.
I'm going to be reading the past reports regarding misconduct in the armed forces, as well as the recent independent review of the military justice system. I will be asking the department for an analysis of the recommendations that have already been implemented, as well as the ones that have not been. And I also hope to hear from as many of our women and men in uniform as possible.
Anand is only the second woman to hold the post of Minister of Defense. Mélanie Joly is Canada's new top diplomat. She becomes the fifth foreign affairs minister in 6 years, replacing Mark Garneau, who is leaving the cabinet. Joly referenced Lester B. Pearson during her news conference.
And of course, the world has changed since Lester B. Pearson, but the vision that we will have at Global Affairs is one that takes into account that very strategic work that Canada is doing across the world, and it will be a mix of humility and audacity.
Joly previously served as heritage minister. Overall, the cabinet stacks up at 39 members, not the largest in history, but the largest for Justin Trudeau. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh is disappointed that former Crown Indigenous Minister Carolyn Bennett is still in cabinet. The NDP had called for Bennett to be removed from Crown Indigenous Services after she withheld documents related to that St. Anne's Residential School. Bennett has been given the new post of Minister of Mental Health and Addictions. Singh says the move raises concerns.
If Justin Trudeau had a problem with the approach taken by the previous ministers, then they probably wouldn't be in cabinet, but they're still in cabinet. So that means he was okay with their approach. That's a problem.
Singh is calling on Trudeau and his new cabinet not to appeal a federal court decision that would see the government pay settlements to Indigenous children who were taken from their communities by social services. And we'll take a closer look for some analysis on the federal cabinet with Craig Oliver in about 80 minutes time or so. Craig will join the show. But in the meantime, let's get to our daily polls. That's also going to relate to the federal cabinet. But first, let's talk about Tuesday's results. Yesterday, we asked you, how often do you donate clothing? 36% of you said every few months. 50% of you said once a year. 14% of you said rarely. And 0% said never. So everybody's benevolent in this audience, which we appreciate. We've got good people who are part of our audience. At AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you find us on Facebook to vote on these polls. Today's poll relates to the federal cabinet, the new cabinet being announced yesterday. Does anything from the new cabinet stand out to you? If yes, please comment. So your options are yes, no, or there's a new cabinet? Question mark. Let's go over to Mike Ross. Mike, I imagine you have a thought or two about the new cabinet that got appointed yesterday.
To me, the thing that stands out most is the appointment of Anita Anand to the defense portfolio. What we've seen and heard as far as the management of the forces over the last couple of years, several years, in fact, is we're committed to making change. We're committed to changing the culture. We're committed to removing the riffraff, if you will, that is stained the Canadian forces. We've heard that for years, but we haven't seen any real action. And if anything, all we've heard in the last little while is top military brass after top military brass being reported, being investigated, in some cases being found to be guilty of harassment and misconduct. So I like the appointment of Anita Anand, someone who really was no nonsense when it came to the procurement of vaccines. Now, whether you agree with that or not, doesn't matter. The fact is, she was the tough public face. She delivered the message every day with authority. And that's what this position needs right now. Mm-hmm. It really does need a tough public face. And she's going to deliver that, I think.
I do think that in that role in procurement, to getting those vaccines and being part of the deployment, she had to work closely with at least a few military officials. So I do wonder if she actually carries some good gravitas and relationships into this role as the Minister of Defense. I do wonder if her success on that file and the relationships she built in the rollouts might actually allow her to really hit the ground running, knowing that there's some top officials there.
But she also had to deal with provincial officials
who
in many cases were not in agreement with her, did not like the way they were doing things at the federal level, and were happy to air that dirty laundry. So clearly she's someone who works well with others even when they're not on the same page.
That's right. Very thick skin. No doubt about that one. Let's bring in Nazreen Abdelmajid. Nazreen, anything from yesterday's cabinet appointment stand out to you?
Not much, but the step up to its efforts on fighting climate change, working harder on reconciliation and building back better to include everyone. I hope that these promises are met. But other than that, not really. Same old.
Yeah, the climate change file is an important one. It's an interesting one. Canadians have identified that as one of their top concerns in recent Léger polling. Seeing that Jonathan Wilkinson is moving over to natural resources, he'd previously been the Minister of the Environment. You know he'll still be involved in a lot of these conversations in regard to the environment. And Stephen Guilbeault is someone who has a certain intensity to his political and environmental beliefs. And I've always been someone who thinks about overcorrections. And maybe we've been a little soft on climate change over the course of the last 15 to 20 years when we knew something was up. So maybe it was time for someone with maybe slightly more radical ideas on the climate front to take on that role. Thank you very much for that, Nazreen. Let's go over to Daniel Panamondo, who can sometimes drift into the political world when it catches his attention. So, Dan, did the federal cabinet catch your attention at all yesterday?
I mean, something that caught my eye. It was just the gender parity that Mr. Trudeau seems to carry forward. He's done that for a number of years with half the cabinet being women. So, I mean, it's good to see that he's continuing that and bringing that forward. That was kind of noteworthy to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a great endeavor on that front as well. As mentioned, we'll talk about this more with Craig Oliver in a little over an hour's time on the show, so you don't want to go anywhere. You want to hang out with us, but in the meantime, vote on the poll. Find us on social media at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. If social media is not your game, you can always send us an email, feedback@AMI.ca, feedback@AMI.ca, or find us via telephone. Give us a ring, ding, ding. Leave us a voicemail, 1-866-509-4545. And don't worry, we will be talking about the Minister of Disability Inclusion, Carla Qualtrough, as well, who is going to be continuing in her role on that disability file. So we'll talk about that with Craig a little bit more. To me, it just strikes me as an affirmation of good progress made on the disability file thus far, and Carla Qualtrough keeping that spot as well. Let's head back to Nazreen Abdel-Majid. She has the National Weather Update.
Thanks, Dave. Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada, starting off with St. John's. Mainly cloudy, chance of showers with a high of 6. Halifax, heavy rain at times up to 15 to 25 millimeters, with wind heading northeast 40 kilometers an hour, gusting to 60, except gusting to 80 along the Atlantic coast, with a high of 12. In Montreal, mainly sunny with a high of 13. Ottawa, sunny with a high of 12. Toronto, mainly cloudy, then clearing with a high of 16. In Thunder Bay, cloudy with a high of 11. Winnipeg, cloudy, periods of rain up to 5 to 10 millimeters. The temperature steady near 9. In Saskatoon, sunshine becoming a mix of sun and clouds, fog patches dissipating with a high of 11 and a wind chill of minus 8. In Calgary, clearing with a high of 10. Edmonton, mix of sun and clouds, chance of showers, then clearing with a high of 12. Yellowknife, cloudy with a chance of drizzle or flurries, fog patches with the temperature steady near 2. In Vancouver, mainly cloudy, 60% chance of showers with a high of 12. And in Victoria, mainly cloudy with a chance of showers with a high of 13. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Nazreen. Coming up next, Rachel Sampson shares findings from Sink or Swim, a new climate change report by the Canadian Institute for Climate Choices. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. According to a new report called Sink or Swim, the global transition to a low-carbon economy is coming, whether Canada and its industries like it or not. Here to share findings from the report is Rachel Sampson, the Clean Growth Research Director for the Canadian Institute for Climate Choices. Hey, Rachel, thank you for making time for us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So in this report, it focuses on the low carbon transition. So I'm going to ask you to start with a little bit of a definition for us. What does that mean exactly? And how quickly is it happening?
Well, what we can see right now is that the global landscape has changed. Right now, we're in a position where countries representing over 70% of global GDP have committed to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions by mid-century. And even if they fail to ultimately achieve those targets, in combination with other things that are happening in the investor community and technological change, this global transition is inevitable. And that means big changes in markets that are important to Canada. Those countries also represent over 70% of global oil demand, over 55% of natural gas demand. So that change is starting, and it could accelerate much more quickly than we anticipate.
Let's go a little bit deeper into some of those markets and industries. What is the impact on many Canadian industries with this transition?
So in the report, we did a stress testing analysis of publicly traded companies under global transition scenarios. And what we found is that many Canadian exporters and multinationals are not yet transition ready. Based on their mix of sales and assets, they would see significantly lower profits through transition than they would without transition. And what that means is for Canada, the stakes are pretty high. These sectors, these transition vulnerable sectors, represent over 70% of our goods exports. There are over 800,000 workers across Canada that work in these sectors. So making the changes needed to be ready for this transition is really important for Canada.
So let's say the preparation does not go into effect, that the transition is not embraced. What would the reality of those markets look like for those industries?
For companies that do not adapt, they don't make the investments in emission reductions or transforming their business lines that they need, they could face significant profit loss. And for some of them, it could mean bankruptcy, and that could then in turn mean job loss. And for some of vulnerable communities that really depend on these companies, they have high levels of employment in transition vulnerable sectors, that could be devastating for some communities. So It really is important. But it shouldn't all be negative. There are huge opportunities in this transition. And if Canada positions itself successfully, we can actually see fantastic growth projections in the future and job creation.
You're absolutely right. There are certainly some positives here. And in fact, the report Sink or Swim does offer numerous recommendations. In fact, let's walk through some of these recommendations that are put forward for Canada to be ready for this transition and embrace the transition. So let's start with forward-looking decision-making. What would that entail?
Well, right now, when we think about climate policies such as regulations or carbon pricing, so much of the discussion is about near-term competitive risks. What is this going to mean for companies in terms of their current profit loss? But what we're saying is when we look forward, it's actually a greater competitive risk to not take action near term, that by these climate policies can help improve the transition readiness of companies, and at the same time as generating demand for newer companies that could be future sources of growth and jobs for Canada.
The second recommendation is a future fit innovation and economic development programming. How would that play out?
Well, what we say is that governments have scarce dollars to invest to help mobilize private investment for transition success. And what we're calling for is a rebalancing. Instead of focusing on a major emitters, such as oil and gas, for example, that we call demand decline sectors, where the biggest impact that they face is declining global demand for their product, that the emphasis should be on areas that are going to be successful through transition. So that includes clean energies and technologies, but also in emissions intensive manufacturers. They can be low carbon steel, low carbon aluminum. In minerals and metals, there's a chance to capture opportunities there, plant proteins. So by emphasizing those sectors and areas where global demand is going to grow, that will help Canada be more successful in the future.
The third one is one that really jumped off the page for me because it's one that I think politicians, analysts, even media members like myself sometimes forget to address when we're having this conversation. And that's a focus on people-focused and transition plans, local and people-focused transition plans. Can you delve deeper into that for us?
Yeah, I mean, our analysis finds that even if Canada in aggregate is successful, there could be significant disruption for these vulnerable communities and for vulnerable individuals. So there needs to be plans that are meaningful for them. And there is no one size fits all. You really need to consider the local circumstances of communities and to focus not just on providing compensation for any job loss that may occur, but to help them attract new sources of investment, new sources of jobs, so that they can be successful over the coming decades.
The fourth one takes me back to some of the days when I was involved in weightlifting and bodybuilding. Actionable disclosure and metrics. I assume that means measurements, being able to make measurable goals.
Yeah, I mean, when we look at how we channel private investment and finance, this measurement of what transition readiness is across companies is really important. Investors need clear metrics to be able to determine whether this company or this project is a transition consistent investment or not. And right now that doesn't exist. It's very hard for investors to distinguish between one company or another.
Rachel, before we wrap up here, can you give folks a little more information about the Canadian Institute for Climate Choices and perhaps where they can find themselves a copy of this report, Sink or Swim?
Sure. We're an independent climate policy research think tank. So we provide research, analysis, and advice guided by a group of expert panels to help Canada achieve climate change goals at the same time as achieving economic growth and well-being goals. And so you can find the report at our website, which is www.climatechoices.ca.
Rachel, it was such a pleasure chatting with you this morning. Thank you for making time for us. We're so appreciative, and hopefully we get a chance to talk to you again down the road.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Rachel Sampson from the Canadian Institute for Climate Choices. For more information on the report and to find Sink or Swim, you can visit climatechoices.ca. Climatechoices.ca is the website. Coming up next, community artist Clover Thursday introduces her brand new segment on arts and culture. Looking forward to this new recurring segment. But first, here is Canadian Press reporter Karen Rebo with your Morning Business Minute.
Canada's main stock index ended a 14-day winning streak of daily gains and record highs ahead of this morning's economic update from the Bank of Canada. Toronto's TSX index lost 111 points yesterday to 21,173. New York's Dow Jones average rose 15 points to a new record high, and the Nasdaq crept 9 points higher. In Tokyo this morning, the Nikkei index slipped 7 points, and our dollar is trading overseas this morning at 80.65 cents U.S. The Bank of Canada is due this morning to announce what will happen to its trend-setting interest rate and will provide an updated forecast for the domestic economy. The bank's target overnight rate has been at 0.25% since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, and Governor Tiff Macklem has said increases won't arrive until later next year when the economy has healed enough. And a three-month strike at de Havilland has ended with the ratification of new collective agreements by members of two Unifor locals in Toronto. From the Canadian Press Business Desk, I'm Karen Rebo.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. We've got another new segment for you on the show. Every other month, we'll be talking about arts and culture. Specifically, we'll discuss how people in the arts community are striving to be more inclusive and accessible. And to help us along this journey, we'll be joined by community artist Clover Thursday. Clover is also a graphic designer and an art enthusiast. Hey, Clover, welcome back to the show. Great to chat with you once again.
Hi, thanks for having me back. I'm so excited.
So, Clover, this is going to be a great opportunity to introduce you to the audience and learn a little bit more about how you became so interested in art. So, how did you become interested in arts? Was there something in particular that sparked it?
Honestly, yeah, I could definitely remember the time where it started moving from like a hobby and an interest to something I really wanted to pursue. And that was like back in high school. Like, I'd been drawing like for a long time as a kid, all up to that time. But I remember taking art classes in school and just having a really enthusiastic and like passionate art teacher. And I had her throughout all the 4 years. And when I was like kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do and like trying to figure things out. And at the time I did know that I did have a disability, like my visual disability. So I wasn't really sure. And then she was just like, oh, I thought you might've been pursuing this. Like, you finished like twice as quickly as the rest of the students. And and she was just like, oh, I think you could really do this. And you know what? Like, I was like, you know what? Maybe that is something I really want to do and something I'm really passionate about. So I kind of started that process, and I had some classmates who used to go to my high school, like help me out, like with my portfolio and stuff. And I just, got into it by like some really supportive people, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the remarkable things, especially when you're going down the pathway of arts. You need that support in your life, people being on your side and kind of pushing you, because it's hard. It's abstract, right? Sometimes it's not always necessarily objective goals in regards to making sure that you're feeling fulfilled as an artist. So as you said, you built up the portfolio, you made the choice to pursue a formal education in art school. So you have to excuse my ignorance here. I am like as unartistically inclined as humanly possible. I almost failed it in kindergarten. So what did you study at art school? What was that experience like?
So what I studied in art school, I have a bachelor's of design with a specialization in illustration. And, oh gosh, like what I got out of it was quite the experience. I wouldn't change it for the world. It had its ups and it had its downs. But, wow, did it like really... it was an experience I honestly wouldn't change for the world. But how I got in was I developed a portfolio again and I had an interview, and I remember the first professor who saw my stuff was like, oh, this is great. There's a lot of good ideas. And then the second one was like, try again next year. And I I remember I was applying with my friend, and I came out of that and I just started like crying. It was just like, but funny enough, I did end up getting in. So I don't know if that was a test or what, but...
Yeah, we face these hurdles in life. I definitely trying to break into this business had a couple of moments along the way where you had a few stumbles and you think, oh gosh, I've got to get a real job. No, that's no fun. Clover, you mentioned that you were going through kind of an awakening as an artist with a disability as well. How did that experience manifest for you in art school as an artist with a disability?
You know, it was really interesting because there was a lot of moments where it just didn't seem compatible. And there is also moments that, in a sense, like having sight loss actually kind of helped inform my practice. I think the one thing that was like kind of shocking to me was that I did, going through art school and in that area, I did run into other artists with disabilities, and even other artists with visual disabilities, you know, people who couldn't see certain things or couldn't see in certain colors or like certain like visual effects like didn't resonate with them. And it was oddly comforting. It was just like, okay, like there's kind of space for everyone here, which was kind of a really cool revelation. And I through that time, I just sort of learned to kind of almost disclose, really, like and it was all really positive experiences when I did that, and people weren't just like, what are you doing here, you know, like. So I think that was something I really learned, of like kind of how to accept the fact that, you know, I do have sight loss, but I am still an artist, I'm still a visual artist. So that was really cool.
Well, let's talk about your process and how you make art. Is there any kind of particular equipment that you use in making your art more accessible to you, or making the process more accessible for yourself?
Yeah, actually. So I remember when I first started, way back in the day, I definitely was more of a pen and paper person. But, you know, as time passed and sort of also as technology kind of, you know, happened, I started working more in the digital space. Like, honestly, technology, right? But I started working in the digital space. And kind of how I kind of work on things, I kind of use more screen zoom and things, not quite voice reader yet, but that kind of helps just me navigate just sort of everything. And I have a setup that kind of really works for me. And I kind of have these own little shortcuts of mine that kind of help me be more efficient in my workflow. So that's been really helpful. Yeah, so mostly just sort of that kind of stuff.
This may sound like a bit of an assumption, but I think you even alluded to it a little bit before. But does working to adapt equipment and adapt your process to make things more accessible actually feel like something of an extension of your artistic creativity?
Absolutely. Like, especially with like a design background, design is very like problem solving oriented. And that's something that, you know, people with disabilities, like, that's something we're kind of a little experts on, you know, like we're always trying to figure out how to make things kind of work for us. So I find that finding all these different ways to make the art making process work for me helps me almost become a better designer, because I do think about those things, and I do think about accessibility, and I do think of, you know, if someone doesn't have a have a means to view my art or see it or experience it or digest it, I'd like to find a way to change that. So I think it really does help inform my own practice through my experience.
So just actually along those lines, as we're wrapping up this segment, and I think we'll definitely dive into this deeper in future segments, but we're always talking on the show about representation and the platforms that can amplify the voices all the time. That's something we talk about all the time on the show. Just as we're wrapping up here, are there any organizations that you kind of want to mention or that you think about that are doing a really great job connecting artists with disabilities and their art?
Yeah, like the first one that just like pops into my mind like flashing is Tangle Plus Arts. They're based in Toronto, and they're just this really great organization that keeps tabs on lots of artists and performers and dancers and so many different people with disabilities, whether it's visual, neurodivergence, deaf. Like it's actually really incredible. And They really practice what they preach. Like their art, like their gallery spaces are accessible, which is actually really difficult in Toronto. And those like urban centers, it's sometimes a bit of a nightmare. So they kind of practice what they preach, and they're always like so ready to connect people with other artists. I got a wonderful chance to work with them in kind of indirectly for some arts events here, even kind of in the Hamilton area. So they're just a really great organization. So I definitely recommend people to check them out. There's also Sketch Arts, also in Toronto, and they kind of help with sort of anyone who's struggling, lots of like youth empowerment programs, especially with people who's experienced homelessness or financial needs. Like they have a lot of really great resources for people. So that's really cool. And honestly, I could list go on and on.
but like, don't spoil all the future segments. We need this stuff exactly. For future segments. Clover, just as we're wrapping up here, though, I do have one more question for you, because something that I observed during the pandemic is a lot of artistic endeavors were catalyzed in terms of the way people maybe had more time to work on stuff, but it was a lot harder to immerse ourselves in that kind of artistic culture. I know, for example, for me, going back to the movie theater has been something that I've really, really enjoyed over the course of the last couple of months. And now we see more museums are opening up, which means more art spaces are opening up. It must feel so good to know that that part of the world is reopening.
It does. It feels really, really good. It's really nice to see kind of all like different art markets and galleries opening up. And it amazes me how much I've like missed being in those physical spaces with the community. Like, honestly, thank goodness for like technology, because still able to kind of keep tabs on that. But it is nice to actually just be in a room and hear the sounds and smell the smells. And so I'm really excited to see what's happening. And hopefully I'll be able to kind of bring up some cool events and things that I see and I share.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, there's an energy when you're in those rooms, when you're at exhibits, especially a lot of the multisensory stuff, right? You mentioned Tangled Plus Arts. We did an audio segment a couple of years ago where we captured a lot of audio at a multisensory event they were doing, and it was so cool, you know, and that's something you just can't replicate through a screen.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hey, Clover, always fun catching up. Thank you for making time for us today. I'm delighted that you're going to be a part of the show and you're on board for recurring segments. So we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. Have a great one. Enjoy the spooky season.
Oh, yes, indeed. Halloween indeed. That's Clover Thursday, community artist and graphic designer. Clover will be doing a regular arts and culture segment with us every couple of months. We'll be catching up with Clover. So that's cool, because as y'all know, I know nothing about art. I like movies. But I've told you before, I almost failed kindergarten art because I could not cut straight, because that's the kind of creativity I have when it comes to hands-on work. It was future lessons for the rest of my life. Assemble that IKEA table. I cannot. This will take me 3 days. Let's go over to Mike Ross for the big business story of the day. Mike, I was just talking about the experience you cannot replicate through a screen. Well, we do know that streaming TV and movies is something folks are doing a lot of, and some of those prices might be on the rise.
Well, they are, Dave. Now, what's interesting about this is, of course, the many conversations we've had over the last maybe year and a half to 2 years about just the number, the plethora of streaming services that are out there. And when, as an individual, financially speaking, is enough enough? When, where do you sort of cap your streaming service dollars and how many streaming services are you willing to go for and maintain, often starting off just to get one show, right? So people hear about Ted Lasso. Oh, I got to watch Ted Lasso, so I'm going to get Apple TV. And then they watch Ted Lasso, and then they never watch anything again, but they forget about that money they're dishing out every month for that subscription. Well, Crave is one that has really made a lot of inroads in Canada over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And they, of course, bring they brought their customers a library of HBO titles, Showtime, and Crave Originals for only $9.99 a month for the last several months. Now, that is being rejigged. The entire service being rejigged. There is now going to be a new mobile-only option. So subscribers are now going to have two choices, both of which give them the access to Crave's entire lineup of HBO series, some HBO Max shows, Showtime, and a selection of new movies. Crave Mobile will give viewers access to the entire Crave library through a mobile app or the Crave website, but you're limited to one viewer stream at a time on a single registered mobile device. Mm-hmm. And that will still be $9.99 a month, but you're limited in your ability to watch it, where you can watch it, how many people on your account can watch it, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Cracking down on that one. Mike, you mentioned the choices that people make on this front. What someone was telling me that they do, and I think this is pretty brilliant, is they set up rotations. They'll say 3 months a year I'm doing Netflix, 3 months a year I'm doing Crave, 3 months a year I'm doing Apple TV Plus, and they just crush through everything in those 3 months. They suspend their accounts or they cancel their account, and then away they go to the next one. I think there's something to that. There definitely is a way to maximize the way you embrace those services and maybe even don't deal with some of that decision fatigue that can kick in on a Saturday night where you're like, what on earth am I going to watch? How on earth am I going to find something?
The deal with that, though, Dave, when you're talking about those people, is it's the wiring that these people have, the ability to really juggle everything, be on top of everything. Yep, yep. I mean, there's a commercial out there. I can't even remember what it was. Maybe it was for a bank where they're making fun of a couple of people who got the Catflix, app. And the fact that that even the banks now are willing to set up a program within your bank account to remind you, hey, you're still paying for this subscription. You might want to look into whether or not you're still paying attention to it because you are paying for it, which I think is brilliant, right? Just somebody else at a bank thinking outside the box of another way of making some more money for the banks. But so many people do not stay on top of their streaming accounts. Never mind streaming accounts. Their subscriptions, period.
Yeah.
And we're just, you know, we're lazy sometimes, Dave, and we end up paying for that laziness.
My Netflix is like up to like $15.99 or $16.99 now. And like, I'm just totally ambivalent to it. I'm like, raise the price, whatever. I use the service. That's fine. Mike, thank you for this.
You're welcome.
That's Mike Ross with the big business story of the day. Coming up next, we'll catch up with Amy Amanti. She'll tell you all about Vocalize's new virtual production, Done-Undone. Done-Undone. Done. I'm weird. We should take a commercial break. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's head out to the West Coast and catch up with community reporter Amy Amanti, who joins us from Vancouver, British Columbia. Hey, good morning, Amy.
Hey, good morning, Dave. Twice in 1 week.
A double dose of Amy Amanti. How's the rainstorm? Is it finally passed for you guys? I know you were getting walloped for days out there.
Yeah, I must say, I think there's a couple of spots on my deck that have some leaks in it.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
So we're catching water in buckets, you know?
Okay, well, we've got to bail out Amy Amanti.
That's right. That's right. But that's part of the Vancouver lifestyle.
Yeah.
Well, unless you're in a $10 million home, which I'm not.
But, well, you never know. Pretty much any home could be a $10 million home in Vancouver, the way things are going out there. Okay, enough about the housing market and the rain. Those are the two Vancouver cliches that you can always count on. Amy, we've been talking extensively about the incident on set at the film Rust that involved a prop gun that ended up being fired by actor Alec Baldwin, who unfortunately fired a gun and killed the director of photography. Yesterday, Mike Ross shared his experiences on using a prop gun on set. And Amy, we know that you've been involved in so many theatrical productions over the years. How about yourself? Have you ever had any experience with a prop gun during a production?
Yeah, you know, and I very much appreciate what Mike shared yesterday as well. It is quite enticing when you have a weapon because it is not something that's a part of our everyday lived experience, right? So you're like, oh, what is this? Oh, feel the weight of that. Oh, interesting, right? So it's like a human behavior to want to interact with this thing because you think it's a safe place to do that. My perspective comes from the theater background as opposed to being on set for film and television with a weapon. And so I was in a production where we had a gun. And what I thought was really interesting about that process was we were told right off the bat that this was it wasn't a replica, wasn't plastic, but that it was a decommissioned firearm. So it was at one point an active working firearm. It was never loaded with any bullets, although there were prop bullets because in the scene, the character has to load the gun. So there were these shells that had been fired off. So they were, for all intents and purposes, hollow. They were about 2 inches long and you could, you know, like shove a pencil in the end of them, right? Because they were hollowized. But there was one person on the set. So our set director was the one person that had permission, a license to rent it, had gone through all of the safety protocols in order to even rent the firearm as a prop. Then when it gets brought on stage, it's in a lockbox and you don't get to access it. There's only one person, and that is the actor that is using the gun that gets to touch it. So the rest of us weren't even allowed to touch it or experience it. It lived in its lockbox the entire time. And one of the most important things was about the fact that this is not a toy, right? We don't point this at anybody. So even the gun was pointed at me in the scene, and it went, you know, and there was a shot fired. Do I die? Dot, dot, dot. I'll never tell. But at the end of the day, right, like the gun, it's a cheat. It's a cheat for the audience. It's not actually pointed at you. And in fact, last night at my rehearsal, because y'all know that I'm in a play coming up, we were doing fight direction, and it's the same kind of concept, right? When you throw a punch, that punch is so far away from the actor, you couldn't possibly make contact. Mm-hmm. But the audience can't tell that because you're turning your body in a way that's a cheat for them, right? So it looks very authentic.
Yeah, it's all part of the process, and the protocols that are in place are meant to be there to try and protect people. And certainly it's one that I know, as I mentioned, after we spoke to Mike yesterday, I was having dinner with some actor friends who it's all they've been talking about for days. And I'm sure it's been talked about in your circles extensively as well.
And it will continue. Yeah,
for sure. For sure. Well, Amy, speaking of productions, Vocali is going to be hosting another almost live event for the production called Done-Undone. So what's this play all about, Amy?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting piece. You know, as everybody knows, during COVID, theaters went dark. We weren't allowed to have in-person productions. So a lot of our production companies here in Vancouver had pivoted to online content. So Vocali, of course, is doing an almost live party every Wednesday night, tonight being one of them, Rocky Horror Picture Show tonight. Plug for that. But next week we're doing Done Undone. I know, I'll be wearing fishnets.
Oh, yeah, rock and roll.
So Done Undone is a Bard on the Beach special. Okay, so Bard on the Beach is like typically you go to Bard on the Beach. It's a Shakespeare festival under tents on the beachside. Those tents haven't been up for 2 years because of COVID. So Bard was trying to pivot too. And Done Undone is a really interesting, it's filmed like a movie. So it's not necessarily a stage production that's been filmed, but filmed like a little movie with two actors that are playing all the characters. And the content is about the discussion as to whether Shakespeare is still relevant. Because there's a lot of racism and a lot of ableism and a lot of sexism in Shakespeare content. And while it's open source, because Shakespeare's been dead hundreds of years, you can take the play and you can change it and adapt it. And Bard on the Beach actually 1 year did As You Like It to Beatles music, which was fantastic.
Nice.
But this is, yeah, and this is a whole discussion around the relevance of Shakespeare from these perspectives of these two actors. One of the actors is a person of color, and one of them is a white dude that's going to be playing Hamlet, and he's like all for Shakespeare, and the woman of color is like, well, wait a second, like, let's examine this. And it's a really interesting deep dive into the discussion of Shakespeare's content.
Really fascinating subject matter there, and I think that's one that a lot of folks might be interested in tuning into. So when's it taking place and how can they get access?
So November 3rd is going to be the night that we share Done Undone on the Vocalite platform, which will open at 6:30 p.m. Pacific time. And you can register through the Vocalite website, which is vocalite.ca, vocalie.ca. And I want to throw out this hotline number because, you know, if you're not somebody, because you can call in to the events with a touchtone phone, you know, if you just, because they're described, right? This is a described event. So if you don't have access to a computer, we also have a 1-800 hotline where you can hear all the listings of upcoming events. And that's 1-833-548-3393. And it's a great hotline. You'll hear my voice telling you all about the upcoming programming.
In case they haven't heard your voice enough already this week, on Monday, right? Wednesday, they call the hotline, get a hold of Amy Amanti on demand, beyond, of course, listening to your podcast as well. I mean, it never stops. It never stops. Amy, one more event to get to here. After a brief hiatus, Access for Sight Impaired Consumers is back. But give us a bit of a reminder. Who are they and the work they do?
Yeah, so I thought that this was really important. I was on the board for Access for Sight Impaired Consumers for about 6 years, and then it kind of went dormant a little bit in 2017. We all needed a break. We were filing human rights complaints and getting the Script Talk instituted in British Columbia. It's a really important organization for BC Access, and at the time, it was not a provincially registered society or charitable organization. We were supported by the CNIB, and that was fantastic. But now they've reemerged because there has been some discussion around a drug called Avastin. Now, this drug has been around for a very long time. It's actually a colorectal cancer drug that gets injected into the eye, but it is not Health Canada approved. It's being used off-label for the treatment of macular degeneration in seniors. But what... there are some tricky side effects that people aren't being made aware of. So their doctors are using this drug. And I'll be honest with you, I had this drug too in my early days of losing my eyesight. And I was told nothing about this injection that I got in my eye. And to be honest with you, my retina detached, whether it's, you know, whether it's related or not, we'll never know. Mm. But it can potentially cause glaucoma, which is also... So now imagine you have macular degeneration. And then you get the injection and, oh, a side effect could be, you know, the raising of the pressure in your eye causing glaucoma, yeah, which is also something you might lose your sight to, right? Mm-hmm. You kind of want to maybe know that before you go into it so you can make an educated decision. But there are a segment of ophthalmologists here in British Columbia that are just administering it like we hand out Halloween candy without any real thought process or due process. So Access for Sight Impaired Consumers is now petitioning lawmakers and change makers around how we make sure that this information gets distributed through the ophthalmologists to the patients.
That is really, really important advocacy, and I'm glad to hear that the movement has kicked up again and gotten started after that hiatus. ASICBC.ca, ASICBC.ca, and that'll go up on our blog after the show, AMI.ca/now blog for more information. Hey, Amy, always fun catching up. Thank you for making time for us today. Good luck with all your practices. Good luck with the fishnets, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the rehearsals, all the things that you do. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you again next week.
It'll be a fun week. Thanks, Dave. Enjoy yourself.
Amy, when do you sleep?
Well, not often. We'll just say that out loud.
Fair enough. All right. That's Amy Amanti, a community reporter in Vancouver, BC. Of course, you can find out more information on the stories we cover on the blog, AMI.ca/now blog. And of course, you can also find Amy's podcast, Accessing Art with Amy, on your favorite podcasting platform. Let's wrap up the hour by sharing a couple of news stories. Let's give you an update on COVID-19 in Canada. Currently, there are 25,601 active cases of COVID-19. So those active case numbers do continue to tick down. 28,841 people have died in Canada since the beginning of the pandemic of COVID-related illnesses. Saskatchewan health officials are rolling out the details of their plan to vaccinate children once approval is given for a COVID-19 vaccine for children between the ages of 5 and 11. Dr. Tanya Diener, who is with the Health Authority vaccine team, says getting these children vaccinated will help with several vaccination rates, and the province continues to deal, as the province continues to deal with rates of infection and hospitalization.
Getting kids immunized is also part of getting back to normal. It's so important for kids to be part of a social environment in the education system, being part of extracurricular activities.
Saskatchewan health officials say they expect to be able to roll out a child vaccine in the next month. British Columbia announced a plan for all eligible residents aged 12 and up to get a booster shot by next May as part of a program that is already underway for those at higher risk of breakthrough infection. Provincial Health Officer Dr. Bonnie Henry says the general population will be eligible for booster shots starting in January.
So everyone in BC who has received their two doses, who wants a booster dose, will be eligible to receive it at least 6 months after their first the dose two.
Henry says appointment bookings will be offered based on the time since the second dose, typically 6 to 8 months. Let's look at the vaccine rollouts more broadly. The provinces and territories administered over 67,000 doses of vaccine yesterday, which means that 88.70% of eligible Canadians have received one shot, while 83.95% of eligible Canadians are fully vaccinated. And then looking to a story out of the Yukon, multiple injuries were confirmed after the RCMP said it was investigating reports of shots fired in the small community of Faro, Yukon yesterday. Outgoing Mayor Leonard Faber expressed shock at the shooting.
It's a small community, and it's going to affect everybody in the community. Involved in this is going to be affected one way or the other, and it's a very sad day.
The Mounties said a possible suspect was identified and an arrest was made in the town, which is about a four-hour drive northeast of Whitehorse. That's all the time we have for the first hour of the show. Remember, if you hear something that catches your ear or catches your eye, make sure to reach out to the show and let us know to give us your feedback. Send us an email, feedback@ami.ca, feedback@ami.ca. @AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter, or you can give us a phone call, 1-866-509-4545. That's 1-866-509-4545. One of these days, I'm going to stop reminding you about the phone number, because at this point, you should have it in your speed dial so you can call us up on demand. Like that. Be like, oh, I got to talk to Dave. Leave him a voicemail. Boom. 1-866-509-4545. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown coming to you on AMI Audio, AMI TV, AMI.ca, and the mighty AMI Audio Podcast Network. I'm your host, Dave Brown. It's Wednesday, October the 27th, 2021. Coming up in the second hour of the show, veteran political correspondent Craig Oliver will give his perspective on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's new cabinet, and Mike Agarbo of The App Show will tell you about the newest edition of the Apple AirPods. Okay, so the quick thought on that I didn't share in the first hour of the show in regards to the AirPods, I wonder at what point we're going to stop referring to headphones as headphones and just start calling them the AirPods, in the same way that a lot of sort of earpiece headphones got called AirBuds or EarPods pretty much immediately, in the same way that MP3 players became iPods. I wonder at what point, of course, like the podcast thing, like has that built-in nature of like the iPod podcast. I'm curious at what point we might have the shift towards all headphones just being called AirPods. I wonder. It's thoughts that I have. Dave, thoughts. On a Wednesday morning. Hashtag Dave Thoughts. Let's bring in Mike Ross for the regional news updates.
Oh, sorry, Dave. I'm putting my cans on. I'm going to call them cans.
Industry terms right there. Got your cans on, baby.
You got it. Let's begin in British Columbia. A group of First Nations in northern BC has declared a state of emergency over the opioid crisis, issuing a statement calling for federal and provincial support. Carrier Sicani Family Services, or CSFS, and 11 chiefs from the area say they're seeking government funding to build a healing center that would offer detox services and traditional as well as Western treatments and supports. Chief Karina Lewin says the call comes as three more people from communities served by the agency have died in the past 2 weeks as a result of the crisis. The statement says the agency already has a strong track record of designing and delivering services, and what they need now is funding for the center, which would also meet calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To the Prairies and two rival Alberta politicians having a rare moment of agreement yesterday about the Prime Minister's pick for Environment Minister. Stephen Guilbeault, former leader of Greenpeace Quebec, has been appointed to the position by Justin Trudeau. Premier Jason Kenney says he's worried that Guilbeault will impose a radical agenda that will lead to mass unemployment. NDP leader Rachel Notley says she shares concerns about some of the positions taken by Guilbeault in the past, including some of his anti-pipeline commentary. To Ontario, and a man has been charged in a fraudulent COVID-19 vaccination certificate investigation that began last month. Ottawa police say the 27-year-old man from Gatineau, Quebec, is facing multiple charges, including two counts of uttering a forged document, two counts of forgery, and conspiracy to commit an indictable offense. The man was released from custody. He's scheduled to appear in court at a later date. The force is reminding residents that selling, purchasing, using, or knowingly accepting false COVID-19 vaccination credentials is a criminal offense. And to the Atlantic region, New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs is facing a growing backlash to his government's new policy on Indigenous land acknowledgements. A series of leaked emails reveals Education Minister Dominic Carty and Transport Minister Jill Green wrote to the Premier on October 15th, complaining the policy creates unnecessary conflict and, quote, creates the impression of a government intentionally reinforcing racist behavior, end quote. The policy forbids government employees from making territorial or title acknowledgments in reference to Indigenous lands. The practice has become common across Canada for politicians and others to begin events by stating that they are standing on unceded territories of various Indigenous peoples. And those are your top regional headlines going coast to coast across the country.
Thank you very much, Mike. Let's catch up with Jeff Ryman. It is time for a sports chat. So, Jeff, usually in this segment, you and I like to pal around and joke and have a lot of fun in the world of sports. Well, it's no laughing matter and it's no fun out of Chicago Blackhawks hockey team. The fallout of a sexual abuse scandal is really starting to take hold.
Yeah, it really is. And we're starting to see a lot of people resign. Yesterday, Stan Bowman, the president of hockey operations for the Chicago Blackhawks, did step down after this report came to public knowledge. And if you're not aware of what happened 11 years ago during the 2010 Stanley Cup playoff run, that year where the Chicago Blackhawks won the Stanley Cup, there were sexual abuse claims within the organization. Apparently, a video coordinator abused a player. And the player went to the higher-ups and said, hey, this is what's going on. Can you guys please file a report? Nothing got reported, and here we are 11 years later. Dave, 11 years later, finally figuring out that the team knew about it but just didn't do anything about it. So yesterday, this all became public knowledge, and long story short, Dave, the hammer didn't really drop on the Chicago Blackhawks. The NHL gave a little slap on the wrist. A $2 million fine is coming towards the Chicago Blackhawks. It boggles my mind that, you know, this is still, you know, the NHL hasn't done the right thing, is what I'm trying to say here. You know, covering things up, $2 million fine. It's just an awful look on the NHL and Chicago, who once again, Dave, once again is in the midst of horrible news. Last year, of course, the Hakeem Alou stuff that came to fruition and came to the surface. And now we have this. Not a good look on NHL and in hockey in general here, Dave.
And the tentacles will continue to reach. Of course, Joe Quenneville, who's now the coach of the Florida Panthers, was named in that report. Montreal Canadiens general manager Marc Bergevin, not named in the report per se, but there are a lot of questions swirling in Montreal about what Marc Bergevin may have known as well. So although Stan Bowman resigned yesterday, the tentacles of the story will continue to reach out as we have these conversations about sexual misconduct within that organization and more broadly inside the hockey world. Jeff, on to much more happy news. A lot of national TV games tonight. There's an early one featuring the Toronto Maple Leafs, but I think a lot of folks are going to have their eyes on the late game, 10 p.m. Eastern time on Sportsnet, the Philadelphia Flyers visiting the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah, the Edmonton Oilers undefeated so far this season, Dave. Kind of a surprise to me. I thought they would regress. I mean, some of the moves they made in the offseason, getting rid of some decent NHL defensemen, bring in some maybe older and, not as experienced defensemen, overpaying for some defensemen, kind of boggled my mind. But here we are, they're undefeated at the top of their division. And I mean, Connor McDavid is really starting to steal the show. I mean, starting is probably not the right word to use because
there's this guy, Connor McDavid.
This.
We're just starting to learn about him. I think that guy might be a star.
Absolutely. And, he's really been the talk of the town the last couple of days. And Dave, I want to pick your brain. First of all, do you buy into Edmonton, what they're doing? Do you think they can keep it up and obviously not go undefeated throughout the entire season? That would be kind of ridiculous.
82-0, baby.
Dave, do you think they're a playoff team? And what do you think the limit is for Connor McDavid?
So, number one, they're definitely a playoff team. The Western Conference is a weak conference. 5-0, I try not to draw too many conclusions that early into the season, as we talked about with the Toronto Maple Leafs yesterday. You don't want to be overreacting only 7 or 8 games into the season. That said, a good start is a good start. Once you put points on the board, you cannot take those points off the board. People are certainly excited about McDavid and Draisaitl. And the fact is, Edmonton, on any given night, that power play is going to scorch you. Wayne Gretzky on the TNT broadcast last week said, the power play Edmonton has going now is better than anything we had going in the 80s on the Oilers. And now, of course, Wayne is doing the broadcaster. He's there having a little bit of fun, probably doing a tiny bit of self-deprecating. But when you're getting praise from the greatest point getter of all time in NHL history, who ran a deadly power play, when they're giving you that kind of love, then I think you have to take it. And whether or not Edmonton is a Stanley Cup contender, I think that's a little bit of a stretch, but they are most certainly a playoff team. And the aspirations for that squad is definitely not to get swept in the first round like they did last year. It's to go on a run. And whether or not we liked the acquisition of Duncan Keith and the dropping of Ethan Bear, they liked that move. They thought that move was going to do something in regards to a leadership core. They did not address their goaltending. It has not come to fruition to matter just yet. But I'm going to pull a Jeff Reimann and say, we'll see. What do you think, Jeff?
Yeah, you know what? I think there's going to be a little bit of a fall from grace here. Of course, like you mentioned, it's going to be really hard for them to go 82-0 here, Dave. But at the same time, playing devil's advocate to your points, their top six looking really good. The addition of Zach Hyman has obviously worked wonders for them. He's at a goal a game pace right now. Their top six is set in stone. They look really good. It's just their bottom six that I'm a little bit concerned about. And I'm also still concerned about that defense and goaltending, Dave. That's a huge chunk of their team that I do have a lot of questions for. I think they're going to fall from grace a little bit towards the end of the season. Although, Dave, I will say, when you have Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl heading your team, I guess technically anything's possible. But I think they make the playoffs. I think they squeeze in. I don't think they're going to be a top seed. But I think there's going to be definitely some regression coming their way as we head down the season. And as for Connor McDavid, I think 150 points isn't out of the equation here, Dave. I mean, he's already on pace to surpass 150 points throughout 5 games so far this season. But wouldn't that be something if you saw a player? I mean, there have been some seasons, Dave, where we haven't even seen a player eclipse 95, 100 points, now we're getting McDavid potentially going to 150. I think that'd be quite the feat.
It's important to appreciate those moments when we get them, no doubt about that. Jeff, we should at least take just a moment to talk about the Philadelphia Flyers, because they made a number of acquisitions. They shook up that roster in the offseason, and some of that's already paying dividends. They acquired Cam Atkinson, the forward from Columbus. He's already got 4 goals this year. They acquired Keith Yandel, formerly of the Florida Panthers. He's got 5 assists. Ryan Ellis, formerly of the Nashville Predators, added to their defense core. He's already got 4 points this year. Bounce back year from Claude Giroux, their longtime center. He has 3 goals this year. And Joel Farabee, the player entering his, I believe it's his 2nd or 3rd year in the league. He's leading the team in scoring. This Philadelphia team has reimagined themselves on the fly, and it's paying dividends for them. They could be a really tough out for Edmonton tonight. Philadelphia has Sean Couturier, their top center, will be tasked most likely with shutting down Connor McDavid in this game. This could be a real test in regards to the Edmonton at easy breezy start with this, with Philadelphia Flyers team.
That's the matchup to watch right there, Dave. Sean Couturier versus Connor McDavid. Couturier, one of the best two-way forwards in the game, maybe even the best defensive forward in the game. Locking down Connor McDavid is going to be extremely hard, but that's still going to be a matchup. You mentioned the firepower. Love Joel Farabee. Love Cam Atkinson, what they've done. Travis Konechny is another player that can put up some decent points.
Also has
3 totals.
Goals this year.
And Dave, the one X factor, I think, for them is the goaltending and Carter Hart. Which Carter Hart are they going to get here, Dave? It always comes down to goaltending. Had a dud of a year last year, looked pretty good in his first 2 seasons. He's still just 22, 23 years of age. If he can bounce back and even just give them average performance, I'm not saying they're going to be contenders, but I think they'll make the playoffs, that's for sure.
I've been watching hockey for basically 30-plus years, and every year the goaltending in Philadelphia is a question mark. There's something in the water. Jeff, thank you for this.
See you, Dave.
That's Jeff Ryman. He's at the AMI Sports Desk. The Philadelphia Flyers visiting the Edmonton Oilers tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern time. That game is going to be across the Sportsnet family of networks. Let's head over to Nasreen Abdel-Majid at the AMI Weather Desk.
Thanks, Dave. Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada, starting off with Cornerbrook, mainly sunny with a high of 8. Charlottetown, cloudy, chance of showers with a high of 12. In St. John, we're expecting periods of rain up to 5 to 10 millimeters, wind heading northeast 40 kilometers, gusting to 60 with a high of 12. In Quebec City, mainly sunny with a high of 11. Toronto, mainly cloudy, then clearing with a high of 16. Sault Ste. Marie, cloudy with a high of 11. In Brandon, cloudy, 60% chance of rain with a high of 11 as well. In Regina, sunshine, fog patches dissipating with a high of 10. Lethbridge, mix of sun and clouds, then clearing with a high of 11. Moving to Red Deer, mix of sun and clouds, then clearing with a high of 10. Whitehorse, periods of light snow, then cloudy with a chance of flurries with a high of 2. In Kelowna, mainly cloudy, chance of showers with snow level at an altitude of 1,200 meters, fog patches with a high of 12. And in Vancouver, mainly cloudy, 60% chance of showers with a high of 12. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Nasreen. Coming up next, Mike Agarbo of The App Show will tell you about the newest edition of the Apple AirPods. But first, Facebook has a big event coming up. Here's Derek Dennis with Tech Trends.
Connect 2021 could be the event where Facebook shows off a new high-end virtual reality headset, which would slot in above the company's popular Quest 2. Ian Hamilton is the managing editor of Upload VR.
A Quest Pro is likely in the cards. This would be a different class of device than what we've seen out of the Quest 2.
He says a premium VR headset would likely feature more sophisticated hand tracking.
Being able to do a whole range of motions that you couldn't do in a Quest 2 reliably.
Facebook dominates the entry-level market with the Quest 2, but
that may not be so true in the high end of the market.
Apple, Amazon, and Sony are all reportedly working on their own high-end virtual reality systems. With Tech Trends, I'm Derek Dennis, ABC News.
Welcome Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's talk tech with Mike Agarbo of The App Show. You can find The App Show Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. And today, Mike is joining us from Budapest, Hungary. Man, the Mike Agarbo world tour continues. Hey, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So, Mike, let's jump into the first topic here, which is Apple's new AirPods. At its showcase last week, Apple introduced new updates to its Mac Mini and its Mac Pro. But let's begin with the AirPods. Tell us about the updates to these snazzy headphones.
Yeah, they have refreshed. I think this is generation 3 of the AirPods. They've added spatial audio now. So if you're a big Apple Music fan, a lot of the music there can take advantage of this new feature. So it kind of envelops you in the environment, so to speak. Better battery life on them as well. And I think coming in around the $200 mark for them.
Not too shabby. Okay, Mike, I've got to press pause here for a second. Are you in the middle of a town square right now?
I think I might be, yeah. I think there's like a big cathedral or something behind me right now, St. Stephen's, in the middle here of Budapest. It's pretty stunning.
My gosh. When I grew up, I want to be Mike Agarbo. Let's jump into the world of the Mac Mini and MacBook Pro. What did we learn about this, a new edition of the Mac Mini? I know it's one that a lot of people like because it's a nice budget option to get some of that Mac computing power.
Yeah, not much updated on the Mac Mini. What they really were announcing with the updates to the chips they're using, especially in the new Mac books that are coming out. Basically a Pro and a Max version. And, you know, we've spoken about this before. Apple is getting into doing their own processors. They've done away with the Intel chips going forward. So these are the latest generations. And anyone who's into doing video editing or photography, any type of creative work, they are salivating over these new MacBooks because of the sheer power on them. So in many cases, depending what you're doing, 2 to 5 times faster than the predecessor, and basically way pretty well Windows laptops in the market right now.
Mike, yesterday on the show, we talked to Nelson Rego a teensy bit about the new music voice plan, but give us a bit of a reminder about what it is.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting thing that they did. So this is only going to work on Apple devices that have Siri. And so they're trying to create another, I guess, entry-level price for people to get into the Apple Music subscription world. So typically, you know, it'd be around the $10 mark for Apple Music. But with this, they're coming in at $4.99. But you have to use your voice. You have to use Siri to select your songs and your playlists. So, you know, if you've got an iPhone or one of the new HomePod minis, which are coming out in a whole bunch of different colors, this might be a plan for you. So basically, using Siri, you just tell it what kind of songs or genre of music you want, and it'll play it back on that particular device. You won't be able to go into the app to select particular songs. You can with your voice, but not in the app. So I guess they're just trying to get more customers in, essentially.
Very good. That's really cool. Well, let's go from one tech giant to another tech giant over to Apple, over to Google, where they introduced their new Google Pixel 6 and the Pixel 6 Pro at a showcase last week. And some industry observers have called the new Pixel the biggest one-year-to-year phone upgrade seen in a long time. Mike, that's kind of high praise. Do you agree with that sentiment?
I have to say, yeah, we've had a chance to actually use it on our trip here so far, and they've really upped the game with this particular one. There's been a lot of complaints in the past, previous Google Pixel phones about the battery life. They've fixed that. They've put a fantastic new camera system in this new phone as well. It's 50 megapixels, but they're actually split that into 4 and then combine that into producing one picture. The bottom line is it's allowing in more light to get better photography. And they've also got some kind of cool features as well. One of them that I like is called Magic Eraser. And this is kind of neat. For example, we were at this big palace in Austria last week, and we took a picture of the palace, but there's all these pesky people in the way. Using your finger, you could basically erase them out of the picture, and it just would automatically take them off. It's just simply stunning.
Oh my gosh, you feel like Thanos with that kind of power, just snapping your finger and making people disappear. Mike, in regards to that year-over-year upgrade, the Google Pixel was already a well-thought-of phone. In fact, a lot of users who have it really, really like it at its price point. But when we're talking about this kind of technological upgrade year-over-year, does this now put them in the same conversation with the flagship phones of, say, Samsung or Apple?
I would say, yeah. And, you know, from our initial tests over the past week, some of the other journalists I'm traveling with would say this is the number one Android phone on the market at this point. So they've improved, again, all these features, the camera system, the battery. They've got their own chip inside now. So they're kind of like Apple making their own chips. It's called the Tensor chip. So they're able to do a lot of the computation and the AI right on the device itself. So for example, it'll just automatically transcribe your voice into text or translate different languages automatically in the phone itself without having to go to the cloud to do it. So they've really upped the game on this one.
And let's jump over to one more tech company, because Huawei also unveiled some new products. They announced a pair of new smartwatches dubbed the Watch GT3, as well as a new pair of wireless earbuds called the FreeBuds Lipstick. That sounds kind of confusing. Let's take these one at a time. The Watch GT3, what are we looking at in regards to this smartwatch?
I think the big feature with this is that it's now coming in two different sizes, a 46 millimeter and a 42 millimeter. It's made for people that are into health and fitness. It's got over 100 different workout modes built into it. It does the heart rate monitoring, probably better than most other wearables in the market right now. They've really upped the sensor quality and size on it. But the big thing for me, and I think for a lot of people that are using wearables, is the battery life. You know, I look at Apple Watches, for example. You're lucky if you get a full day out of that battery. These can go for 2 to 3 weeks, depending which size you get, which is just phenomenal.
Wow, that is quite a long battery life. No doubt about that one. What are we looking at in regards to a price tag?
They haven't announced the full Canadian pricing yet, but we're anticipating in the $300 to $400 range for these. So, you know, for the features that are built in, the battery life, this is, you know, probably one of the better value wearables out in the market right now.
And let's finish up by talking about these FreeBuds, the FreeBuds Lipstick. Again, I think that's such a bizarre name for a set of earbuds, but who am I to decide? I'm not in the marketing department. It's okay. Mike, tell us a little bit about these earbuds, what they want to accomplish here.
It was funny at this event, you know, they're announcing all these, you know, a new phone for Europe and, you know, these new watches, but everyone was blown away by these Lipstick earbuds. So the feature, just the form factor, look like regular wireless earbuds, but they fit in a special case that looks like a lipstick case. With the lid on, you would not be able to tell it apart from an actual lipstick, essentially. You basically open it up, the case is magnetic, so it's, you know, snapped on and off quite nicely. And the little earbuds are like this bright red, kind of, I guess, to mimic lipstick color. But it's pretty cool. So there's like a battery in the case that helps charge them when you're out on the go. And I think it's more kind of a fashion statement, essentially. So, you know, if you're interested in getting your loved one some new wireless earbuds and they're kind of into the fashion world, these are the must-have for Christmas if you can get your hands on them.
Any word on the price tag for these bad boys?
They haven't announced the official one, but we're thinking in the $200 to $250 range when it hits Canada. So, you know, if you've ever had a chance to try out Huawei's other earbuds, they always make some of the best ones in the marketplace. So these are going to be pretty good too.
Mike,
and they look cool.
Mike, thank you so much for taking some time away from your trip to talk to us today. Very jealous of your globe-trotting lifestyle. Enjoy Budapest.
Thank you. See you guys.
That's Mike Agarbo. He's the host of The App Show, living the life out there in Europe, in the middle of a town square with a cathedral behind him in Budapest. You can find The App Show Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. I yearn to journey. I'm just going to live vicariously through Mike Agarbo. Coming up next, veteran political correspondent Craig Oliver will give his perspective on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's new cabinet. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's take a closer look at the new federal cabinet. Stephen Guilbeau is taking over as Canada's environment minister. Minister Guilbeau says the cooperation will be integral in dealing with climate change.
But they're also telling us we need to do more. They want us to do more. They want us to go faster. And we need to do that by working together all across the country. Climate change affects us all from coast to coast to coast. And we've seen last summer, certainly in Canada, but not just in Canada, how the impacts of climate change are becoming more and more important as years go by.
Former Environment Minister Jonathan Wilkinson is moving over to the Natural Resources portfolio. Former Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller is shifting over to a new portfolio as Minister for Crown Indigenous Affairs. He says his focus during the pandemic was to keep people alive, and the greatest impediment was not a lack of resources, but a lack of trust. He hopes he's now built up a degree of trust with First Nations that he can bring to his new role.
This relationship started with land. The relationship has been broken because of land theft. And it's time to give land back. And that's just the reality of it. It's easily said, it's more difficultly done.
Former Health Minister Patty Hajdu is taking on the Indigenous Services file, and Krista Freeland is staying on in her role as Deputy Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance. Freeland had previously been one of the most prominent voices advocating for the government's national daycare program. For his perspective on this and the new cabinet, we're joined by veteran political correspondent Craig Oliver. Hey, good morning, Craig. How are you?
Good morning, Dave. I'm fine. Thank you.
So let's start here with a big, broad question. Then we can jump into some specifics. Mm-hmm. But what's the big picture here? What do these cabinet appointments indicate to you?
Dave, let me put a headline on this story for you. Just Watch Me 2.0. In other words, as you may be aware, when Pierre Trudeau was in trouble, he threw caution to the winds and took a chance to get himself out of it. His son, Justin, is now doing the same thing. The whole purpose of this cabinet shuffle is to lock in a legacy for Trudeau on the three great issues which are so important to him. And if you noticed, each of the leaders of the three areas we're talking about, which are so important to Trudeau, and that would be climate, First Nations, and daycare, each of the leaders has been thrown out and new people brought in. And Trudeau is taking a lot of risks here with this shuffle, putting people who are in many cases unexperienced totally with the department they're going to be heading, is depending on their judgment badly. There are a lot of risks in this cabinet shuffle. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about those three areas of priority, because as you mentioned, there's new faces in the big file, but perhaps a little bit of continuity in a tandem. So what are your expectations when it comes to the new environment minister, Stéphane Guilbeault, as well as Jonathan Wilkinson as a tandem? Wilkinson will be in the natural resources file. What are your expectations for them as a tandem on the climate front?
Guilbeault himself is a red flag to Alberta and to the resource nations, resource provinces in any big way. The Conservatives have already dubbed him a loony. Well, Guilbeault is an extreme environmental fighter and has been for years. He was in the any number of organizations.
It was Greenpeace in Quebec that he headed up.
Yeah, and he also organized another group in Quebec. He climbed the tower in CN Tower in Toronto to demonstrate. He's been over the top in the minds of many people and someone who is not willing to compromise, and he's the new environment minister. Now you compare that with the new job in the West in natural resources, and that minister is now going to have to cooperate with him. And he won't be able to do what these ministers of natural resources have been told to do in the past, which is to deal with the energy industry and try not to upset them too much. But now he is committed also to the Trudeau agenda of getting a lot done. And you can see that they have no choice. They're talking about getting rid of, 40% of greenhouse gases in only 10 years. To do that, they're going to have to make significant changes that a lot of Canadians aren't going to like. This is going to be a very difficult one for the Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump over to the important conversation we're having in regards to reconciliation, as Mark Miller replaced Carolyn Bennett in the Crown Indigenous Relations file, while the former Health Minister Patty Hajdu replaced him in Indigenous Services. How do you imagine they'll be able to navigate this next crucial phase of reconciliation?
Well, Trudeau thinks he's put himself in a much better position now to deal with that, with a new minister who has been something of an achiever in cabinet. I think that is the hope, at least. There's a long way to go on this yet, even including a very difficult decision the government has to make about human rights and the survivors of the Indian residential schools and the money they feel that is owed to them. And the courts agreed. The federal government has to make a decision whether to appeal that. And as the conservatives are saying, quit fighting with the children. And this is a demand everywhere Trudeau went with from First Nations. Mm-hmm. This is going to tell a lot about where things are at.
That's right. The conservatives have told him to stop fighting it, as have the NDP. We've finally found unanimity amongst Canadian politicians. Craig, let's take a moment to talk about Chrystia Freeland. Now, we did talk about her last week in regard to whether or not she would maintain her two roles as Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Finance. But, Craig, does it appear now that she's clearly the second most important figure in the government, especially considering that she wields the power of the purse and has been front and center in that national daycare conversation?
Yeah, she will be the minister also of national daycare to make that happen across the country. And there's no doubt about that. But also, don't forget this. She's also setting herself up, and the prime minister is, for a prime ministerial role, or at least to run for it, if Trudeau leaves. And that's still a very big if. Now, Trudeau says he's not going to leave. He's going to stick with this. But he doesn't have a lot of time to make a decision. At the most, minority governments only last about 2 years. So Trudeau can't leave the party hanging. He's going to have to make a decision, which he says he's already made, I doubt it, about where he's going.
Mm-hmm. Well, Craig, let's jump into some of the surprises we saw yesterday. Former Minister of Foreign Affairs Mark Garneau is out of that role and out of cabinet completely. Garneau is replaced by Melanie Joly. Joly referenced Lester B. Pearson as she laid out her vision for the position.
And of course, the world has changed since Lester B. Pearson, but the vision that we will have at Global Affairs is one that takes into account that very strategic work that Canada is doing across the world, and it will be a mix of humility and audacity.
Craig, Garneau out completely of cabinet. Melanie Joly taking over this important position at Foreign Affairs. Is this the biggest surprise?
I think it is. I absolutely think it is. First on Garneau, you know, this is a young cabinet, a very urban cabinet, a with it, a woke cabinet, if you like. That's what they how they would like to see themselves. And I guess there just wasn't room for an old timer, a famous Canadian, like the person who's just been dumped as foreign minister. I hope they haven't humiliated this great man. Obviously, there's a big problem there. I think he expected to be in cabinet, probably with the same job he already had in foreign affairs. And I think it sounds like the government is trying to work out some kind of an offer for him. They've dropped to the media that maybe it would be the Canadian ambassador in Paris, whatever. He hasn't said a word. I think there's a lot of unhappiness in the background there. As for the new minister, feel for the Foreign Affairs Department. There are 6,000 people working for that department. They've had five new ministries in 6 years. And they're complaining bitterly that they can never really get their feet, that they can't do the kind of jobs they should be doing. And now they've got a minister who, as far as I know, knows nothing at all, really, about foreign policy and sounded it when she talked to the media briefly yesterday.
Craig, someone who does seem to have a good grasp on her file is Anita Anand, named Minister of Defense. Minister Anand warned there is no magical solution to the problem the armed forces are facing.
I want to assure everyone that I will put in the necessary work for as long as it takes to get this done. As I have said, I am thorough, I am determined, I am dogged, and I am results-oriented, and I will be dedicating all of my energies towards this task and this position.
Minister Anand had previously been in charge of procurement and played a huge role in securing Canada's vaccine supply. In that time, she dealt with military officials as part of the rollout. Craig, do you imagine that her performance on that tricky file is why she's been tabbed to take on this role at a crucial time while the military continues to be plagued with high-profile cases of sexual misconduct?
Dave, I don't think I have to imagine it. People in the government have made it clear that she did such a great job on getting those vaccines. Remember that the Conservatives at one point said it'd be 9 years at the rate the government was going. They predicted a failure to get vaccines that Canadians needed to keep themselves going and keep themselves alive, if you like. But she straightened all that out, and she did what pretty much everyone agrees was a pretty terrific job. And as you've just observed, in the process of doing all that, she was also dealing with the military. And so she understands that whole command and control operation they run there. But there was only one choice in terms of gender. It had to be a woman taking on defense. This is not the first time in history. It's the second time. Kim Campbell did it for a short time. So I think she's in a good position to force the kind of changes the department needs. And a lot of people could not have done that and done it, I think, with the ability she has.
Mm. Craig, a file that's very relevant to our audience is the Minister of Disability, Inclusion, Employment and Workforce Development, Carla Qualtro, staying on in that position. Minister Qualtro has been Minister of Disability since the creation of the position. Is this something of an affirmation of the work that she's done on that file?
It absolutely is. She may not have wanted a change. She has to come in from Vancouver all the time. Life is, it's a very stressful job for her. I'm not sure that she wanted a change. At no point did anybody hint that she did. She's very, very committed to the persons with disability issue and with others. I think one of the things she may press ahead on is trying to improve the income that's available for people and persons of disabilities. Mm-hmm. I think that is in the past been something she cares about. But all of these issues, as we know, but she's still got personnel responsibilities too. But I mean, we're all happy to have her stay where she is. And I hope she's not disappointed, but I don't think so.
Yeah, she's really built that portfolio up from the ground and built so many solid relationships over the course of the last 6 years, developing those relationships with stakeholders. I think that it's probably an important continuity while they're still working on the Accessible Canada Act and new legislation as well. So it does make some sense. Again, I'm sure in her life she has big aspirations, but at certain points when you're on a good track and working well, sometimes you don't mess with good, right? There's an expression that I can't use on the air, but you don't mess with happy sometimes, so to speak.
Right.
Hey, Craig, this is not the biggest cabinet in the history of Canada, but it is Justin Trudeau's biggest cabinet at 39 members. Is a bigger cabinet necessarily a better cabinet?
No. Smaller ones tend to be maybe a little more efficient. But what's important here, Dave, is the judgment of the people who are put in these jobs. You can succeed or you can fail, but you will not succeed if you are not a person of good judgment. And that's why some of these young woke people who, make you feel like saying, I mean, they're such urbanites. It's a very urban, very aggressive, very activist cabinet. But will they be making the right decisions when they have to? That's the whole question. It's all about good judgment when they have to decide on important things to the lives of Canadians.
Craig, let's shift gears quickly at the end here towards provincial politics that have a taste for federal political implications. Alberta Premier Jason Kenney says the results of a provincial referendum show a majority of voters reject the federal equalization program. A referendum during the municipal election a few weeks ago asked voters if they want to see the principle of equalization removed from the Constitution, and 62% voted in favor. Let's hear from Jason Kenney, who says the message is clear.
This is a powerful statement today, a democratic statement where Albertans are demanding to be respected. They're demanding that the jurisdiction of this province under the Canadian Constitution be respected.
It's all fine and dandy that over 60% of Albertans want this equalization system changed, Craig, but does this referendum result actually mean anything, or are we in the world of political pandering?
It's meaningless, and it will be treated by the federal government as it is, meaningless. The fact is the province doesn't have any power under the Constitution to change anything like what he's claiming. I think this is a desperate effort by the Alberta Premier once again to change the focus of the news away from himself and the failings in terms of healthcare and the failings in terms of the pandemic and try to thrust it on somewhere else, somewhere. And I think once again, he's behind. You know, he's really around behind the curve, and it damages him. It's just not realistic. And it's bogus. Also, by the way, there was a very low turnout for this these municipal election votes that it was tied to. So that's not really a judgment about whether Albertans as a group would go overboard about this. And 61% wasn't that great. So even that isn't convincing. But the fact is, the premier can't do anything about it. He knows he can't do anything about it. He can change all the legislation he wants. That doesn't change the constitutional facts that seven other Canadian provinces would have to agree to anything like the kind of change that he's demanding. And by the way, one of the reasons Alberta pays more is because historically Albertans have been higher per capita incomes than the rest of the country because of oil and gas. That may not be as true now, but it's still relatively true.
And the one note that I'll add, Craig, is that Mr. Kenney is very much aware of how equalization works because he was a federal cabinet minister in the Harper government when the most recent formula was worked out. He was at the table, so he knows how this works.
He was at the table, but maybe he wasn't listening, Dave. You and I don't know.
That's a good point. That's a good point. You always catch me on that speculation, Craig. Hey, Craig, thank you for this. It's always a delight catching up. Have yourself a great week, and we will talk to you next Wednesday.
You will, Dave. Bye for now.
That's Craig Oliver. He's a veteran political correspondent. Coming up after the break, we'll catch up with Ramya Amuthan and find out what's coming up on Kelly & Company. Daniel Penamondo will be here to let you know what's going on in the world of entertainment. And Nasreen Abdel-Majid will tell you what's happening in the world of social media. And Mike Ross will wrap up the show by reminding you what happened to this day in history, the now of then. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's look ahead to this afternoon when Kelly & Company hits the airwaves at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Ramya Amuthan is the co-host of that show, and she joins us now with a preview. Hey, good morning, Ramya.
Good morning, Dave.
So what's coming up on the show today?
All right. We have In the Know with Margaret Weldon, and she's going to tell us how learning and understanding the sounds of safety can help prevent fires and, of course, save lives at the end of the day. So we're talking about smoke alarms and carbon monoxide alarms in the house. We're also learning about this initiative called Job Talks Access. They're building a community of accessibility champions who are accomplishing their professional and life goals. Then we're talking about the recent survey that they launched to help understand the feelings and opinions and experiences associated with having a disability while working. So lots to get into there. And also we're talking more about jobs. So when in the hiring process should I disclose my disability for anyone who's in job search right now? Alicia Yardley is going to not answer just this question, but a lot more during our employment talk.
Mm-hmm. Always an interesting question. No doubt about that one. Ramya, thank you for this. Have a great show.
Thanks, Dave.
That's Ramya Amuthan. She is the co-host of Kelly & Company, coming your way 2 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. Let's go across to the other side of the glass to catch up with Daniel Penamondo for the Entertainment Report. So, Dan, what's cracking in the world of entertainment?
New trailer alert. In the Toy Story realm, but not really, but kind of, sort of. Follow me here. This is a report from Polygon.com. After four Toy Story movies, Buzz Lightyear is back. Lightyear is the title of the new film. Is about Buzz Lightyear, but follow me here.
Is it going to be a prequel Joker style, the dark beginnings of Buzz Lightyear?
Well,
just teasing you, sorry.
I mean, you're right about the darker. I'll get to that in a sec.
Oh, okay. Wow. But,
so as we all know, Toy Story 1 through 4, Buzz Lightyear, the famous toy, famous character, he in the world of Toy Story, in the lore of Toy Story, if you will, Buzz Lightyear, the toy, is based on a film in that universe, a big blockbuster film in that universe, right?
Okay. So
Pixar, what Disney and Pixar have done is they've made that movie. So this new Lightyear movie is the movie that inspired the Buzz Lightyear toy that everyone knows and loves.
That's meta. I like that.
It is very meta. I kind of like that too. I dig that. kind of a nice, I don't know, it's not a really a loophole, just a nice little way they kind of imagined getting a new Buzz Lightyear movie.
A different way into reboot culture. I'll give them credit on that, friends.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, Dave, I watched this trailer. I'm quite impressed, actually. It looks very... I mean, the Toy Story movies are great. I don't think I saw the fourth one, but the first three were certainly fantastic. This one looks kind of dark. Like, they're going full sci-fi with Lightyear. Kind of cool. The CGI is incredible, as you expect from Pixar. And, you know, it's going to be for kids. But as usual, as is the case for Pixar, a bunch of adults are going to be, you know, into this as well. They kind of serve both audiences. So set to hit theaters June 17th, 2022. And also... Worthy of note, he is now voiced by Chris Evans instead of Tim Allen.
Okay.
Again, they're not the same.
Bringing Captain America into the mix.
Captain America. All right. So I urge you to check it out, and everyone out there to check it out, because I was kind of, you know, impressed with what they're doing here. It seems kind of cool. I like it.
Well, Daniel, we're a bit tight for time, but yep. I do want to make mention that I'm off to the movies today. Not going to see your James Bond. I'm waiting for you to see that first. But I'm going to see The Last Duel, the new Ridley Scott movie starring Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, Adam Driver, and really interested. Apparently, the reviews have been good. The box office has been terrible. So I'm going to try and do my part. As of now, zero tickets have been sold to the show that I'm looking at 3 p.m.
Yeah, do your part, chip in some of your ducats, and let me know what you think.
Yeah, Ridley Scott needs my money. Daniel, thank you for this.
You're welcome,
Dave. That's Daniel Panamondo with the Entertainment Report. Let's bring in Nisreen Abdel-Majid to find out what's trending. So, Nisreen, what are people posting about on social media this morning?
So one of Canada's top trends is hashtag Dress Purple Day 2021. I was going to dress in purple, but all my purple scarves are packed up in boxes because I'm currently in the middle of a move. So yeah. October, it's been hectic and I wish I wore purple. October 27th, today, people across Ontario raise awareness about the important role that individuals and communities play in supporting vulnerable children, youth, and families through the provincial Dress Purple Day campaign. The pandemic made it worse, as we all know, and has created additional stressors for families and in some cases has increased the risk for the well-being and safety of children and youth. But it's a reminder that it's more than about just wearing purple. Showing your support is a big deal. It includes reporting any concerns for the safety of these children, youth, and families. If you have any concerns, if you hear anything, if you see anything, speaking up. Speaking up is a big move to show your support, and you can save a life.
Nisreen, thank you for this. I appreciate it.
No problem.
That's Nisreen Abdel-Majid with What's Trending. Let's wrap up the show with Mike Ross. He's got This Day in History, the Now of Then.
Dave, October 27th, 1938, DuPont announced it had coined a name for its new synthetic yarn, nylon. The first nylon stockings went on sale May 15th, 1940.
I've been trying to buy a nylon windbreaker for a couple days now, but the old DB's too chubby. Tough to find one of my size.
It's stretchable. What are you talking about?
Well, you don't want it to stretch too much.
1995... In the biggest political rally in Canadian history, thousands of people from across Canada arrived in Montreal to urge Quebecers to vote no in the sovereignty referendum. Days later, Quebec voters narrowly, like nylon thin, rejected sovereignty.
I was there. I was at that rally.
I was not, but I knew a lot of people who did. And I'll tell you, to this day, I kind of regret not being there.
Yeah, you were in Ottawa at the time,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, so,
that's right.
I mean, I was in Montreal, so it was easy enough for me to get there. My mom brought me and my sister. She thought it was really important that the two of us be part of that moment.
And I was in university. It was a big deal.
Oh,
a lot of students from Carleton went to Montreal. And on this day in 2004, the Boston Red Sox won the World Series, defeating the St. Louis Cardinals. In a four-game sweep, it was the club's first World Series win since 1918. And those are your events and happenings this day in history.
That was one of my favorite playoff runs of all time. The Montreal Expos had been disbanded that year. Mm-hmm. I'd had a little bit of a connection to the Red Sox because I have family in Massachusetts and used to spend time in Massachusetts in the summer. And when the Red Sox erased that 3-0 deficit to the Yankees in the ALCS, I was all aboard the hype train, and they absolutely smashed the Cardinals once they got to the World Series. So they slayed that dragon in the semis, and then they ended the curse of the Bambino with a sweep in the finals. It was awesome.
So I'm a bit of a mixed bag of a baseball fan. I grew up an Expos fan. We lost the Expos. I moved to Toronto. I'm kind of cheering for the Blue Jays. But I've always liked the Yankees. I respect the history of the Yankees. Mm-hmm. Been to Yankee Stadium. I also respect the Red Sox. I really respect the history of baseball.
Yeah.
So when the Cubs ended their drought, when the Red Sox ended their drought, I love that. Just as a sports fan, I really love those moments.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's something people talk about, a team that's near and dear to your heart these days, that once the Leafs get that boulder rolling, if they can sort of get over that first hump, they might have some of that success too, that once you get that momentum building, it's tough to stop.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I would love that.
Yes, you would. Mike, thank you for this.
All right, Dave.
That's Mike Ross with This Day in History, the Now of Then. That's all the time we have for this Now of Now. Don't worry, we'll be back again tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Eastern time. The show kicks off. We'll be talking about Treat Accessibly, an organization that's going to make trick-or-treating as accessible and inclusive to as many trick-or-treaters as possible this Halloween season. The show starts 9 a.m. Eastern time on AMI TV, AMI Audio. Until then, I'm Dave Brown reminding you to play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.